Here is a thought. A thought can be an object-like thing in our minds that we summon up and reflect on, maybe move about, manipulate, use to solve a problem, to accomplish many tasks, all mental. It can also be the bare perception of an object. Just this. I'm sure there are other ways to define and appreciate thought. There was the thought arising in our Buddha minds as we chanted the Enmei chant for Reb Anderson. This thought is Buddha mind. There are many forms of thought. The thought, a thought similar to this, but different, was passed to me by my teacher, Zen Master George Bowman, as it was passed to him by his teacher, Zen Master Sung San, the founder of the Quantum School of Zen, as it was passed to Sung San by his teacher in Korea, Kobong, and then who received it from his teacher at the home monastery, so to speak, on a mountain in Korea, where the roots go very, very deep and extend all the way to China. That's a thought, one that I honor. Here's a poem to begin this talk with. It is a verse spoken by a Sung Chan master Yuchi Chi Chong, and his name means Stone River. And he spoke this verse at the cremation of a person called Estate Overseer Tan. For many long years, he was lord of the estate. He knew all about the fields and gardens of his ancestors. At midnight, neither men nor oxen appear. Do not chase after the final phrase. It's just the moon is bright. 75 years under a shadowless tree. Just look at him inside the fire, pulling down branches. 75 years under the shadowless tree. Look at him inside the fire, pulling down branches. I receive this poem as a poem about bodhicitta, And I offer this talk tonight about bodhicitta. I'm not an expert in bodhicitta, but I've been studying it for a while and have something I think of value to share about it. Bodhicitta is the thought of awakening, or the aspiration to awaken, or the wish to awaken through wisdom and compassion that benefits all beings. Every bit of that definition, I think, is important to remember. It's the thought to awaken through compassion and wisdom for the benefit of all beings. We're all familiar with bodhicitta. Maybe some have spent more time looking into it than others. But I wager that you are all more deeply familiar with bodhicitta than maybe you are even aware at times. Bodhicitta is the resource, the energy that animates every practice in Buddhism. Everything we do is energized, motivated by, or animated by bodhicitta, the thought of awakening. Bodhicitta appears everywhere in our scriptures, in our chanting. It's in the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra. It's in the robe chant. It's in the four bodhisattva vows. It's in the five ranks practices. It's in everywhere. It is always in front of us wherever we turn. And for a reason, I think. It's such a foundational practice. And maybe it's one of its most idealized or beautiful expressions is in the long verse scripture known as the Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva, right? Most of us have at least a passing familiarity with Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva. Bodhicitta, when we engage with it, when we really familiarize ourselves with it in our practice, and we devote ourselves to the practice of the thought of awakening, the aspiration to awaken, immediately kind of confers upon us all a designation as bodhisattvas. That's a bodhisattva is someone who has engaged with, accepted, experienced deeply bodhicitta. And it has it's not just an intellectual appreciation of this thing called bodhicitta when I say that it animates all of our practices. It is present even when we're not attentive to it, when we're not aware of it. Shantideva says it's present even when we're sleeping. I'd like to read part of the verse. It's in the early section on bodhicitta. Shantideva says, "Bodhicitta, the awakened mind, is known in brief to have two aspects. First, aspiring, bodhicitta in intention. Then, active bodhicitta, practical engagement. As corresponding to the wish to go and then setting out. The wise should understand respectively the difference that divides these two. From bodhicitta in intention, great results arise for those still turning the wheel of life. Yet merit does not arise from it in ceaseless streams, as is the case with active bodhicitta. For when with irreversible intent the mind embraces bodhicitta, willing to set free the endless multitude of beings, in that instant, from that moment on, a great and unremitting stream, a strength of wholesome merit, even during sleep and inattention, rises equal to the vastness of the sky. Dogen, in the Hotsu, his essay on determination to it, Hotsu, I think that's right. He says something similar. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is undivided, not forced by you or by others. It means your practice affects the entire sky in 10 directions, although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. Take a moment with me and reflect on your day, how it began this morning, and kind of what happened that to you in your mind and in your activities that brought you here right now. I may have been attentive this morning because I knew I was coming to give this talk, but normally I might not be. I might wake up and think, tonight I'm going to be at Valley Streams Zen Center, sitting with friends, practicing Zazen. I have this thought, right? I have the intention. And then I go, I set out at some point, and I'm here sitting with good friends in the posture of a Buddha, right? This is a thought of awakening. It doesn't have to be a conscious thought, may I awaken, or may I be aware that I aspire to awaken. It doesn't have to manifest in that way. The bodhicitta does come unnoticed by ourselves or others, right? This is the way that bodhicitta animates our practice in our lives together. It is happening. It occurred to you today. It occurred to me. I checked with Reb Anderson not long ago and said, is this thought, like, I'm going to come to No Abode today and sit, is that a thought of awakening? Is that bodhicitta? And he said, yeah, it can take that form. And then he said, it can also take the form of respect for your spouse. It can also take the form of feeding your dog, taking your dog for a walk. Even during sleep and inattention, bodhicitta is active, is doing its thing. We're having this thought of awakening. And again, thought can mean many different things, and it appear in many different ways. The first teacher I ever heard speak of a thought as a being was Reb Anderson, And it really struck me when he said, a thought can be a being. And he talked about caring for this being, this thought. The thought may be, I don't want to be here at this talk. I kind of would like to be outside enjoying the summer evening. And that thought is a being that we can care for. But maybe I'll go outside with you very shortly and we'll enjoy the outdoors together. And just, but meanwhile, there's this talk going on. A talk like this, for me, is something that I invite to myself to experience in a particular way. You maybe have heard this phrase before, when something is dark to the mind but luminous to the heart, right? This is the way I try to practice with these thoughts of awakening, the thought of bodhicitta. And when I do, I'm surprised that, oh, this morning I got up and I thought, today I'm going to go to Valley Streams and practice Zazen with friends. And suddenly I see it as a thought of awakening, as the bodhicitta animating my life and my practice. Shantideva makes this point about bodhicitta in intention and active bodhicitta. And I just spoke about appreciating bodhicitta when I'm thinking about it as a thought that is dark to the mind but really luminous in the heart. The heart in this instance is not just the heart here in the chest that beats and provides blood and keeps us alive, but the heart-mind sense of a being. It's luminous to the heart-mind, and the heart-mind includes intention, it includes feeling, it includes thought. It's that whole being, that body that is receiving this bodhicitta that I'm interested in exploring. Bodhicitta is said to be, in Shantideva's verse, aspiring and active. That's also sometimes translated as conventional and ultimate. And in the conventional realm of experiencing bodhicitta and working with bodhicitta, we wake up and we think, I'm going to go to Valley Streams tonight. Or we wake up and we think, I've heard that the teaching is to once a day consciously think a thought of awakening, aspire to awakening, wish to awaken. That would be conventional bodhicitta. And as I hope I provided evidence of, it's working in our lives all the time. Where either, even though we may not think consciously, oh, this is a thought of awakening, this is bodhicitta. And it's appearing in all of our practices, our chants and the scriptures and so forth. Ultimate bodhicitta is something else. There is, again, in the Bodhisattva Way, also found in the Avatamsaka Sutra, which some of us have been studying quite intensely with Reb Henderson for 3 years now. There's a lot of talk about bodhicitta, and both conventional and ultimate bodhicitta. And the ultimate bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta is addressed in the first of the 10 stages of the bodhisattva. There's an eighth stage, but the first stage also correlates with the development of what's known as vision in early Buddhism. It's Darshanmagga, and this vision equates with the ultimate realization of bodhicitta, which is kind of associated with this eighth stage of the bodhisattva. And a particular moment of perception that occurs in all of our lives when we perceive directly the non-dual, when we have a direct experience of the non-conceptual, whenever that moment occurs in our practice as bodhisattvas, that moment is spoken of in the 10 bhumis, or the 10 stages of the bodhisattva, as being the moment when your perception of reality is so altered that you can't go back to seeing things the way you used to see them. And this is really, for me, a very alive, special, important point when it comes to practicing in a way that helps all beings, right? Bodhicitta is the thought of awakening through wisdom and compassion to benefit all beings. There is a benefit. We work to help people awaken, to come out of a state of ignorance where there's a sense of separation of self and other. And we see that that's diluted. It's not the way things really are. The way things really are is non-dual. When we have that awakening, the world, the reality that we live in and that we experience is changed forever, and we don't go back to it. And it says that the effort to benefit beings, living beings, becomes effortless. It's really difficult, but it's also effortless. And you'll know when you reach that stage in your practice, because it won't be such an effort. The difficulties will be there. You'll still feel this is a very difficult practice to try and save all beings. It's really difficult for me to get up out of bed and go tend to a sick relative who's in the house. I'd like to stay in bed. It's difficult to deliver food and to the homeless. It's difficult sometimes to get up and come to the zendo and sit with friends and be open and straightforward with people. But these difficulties are suddenly effortless, right? When we reach this point where we see in the reality, our view of reality changes in that way, there's no going back. It's like, what do you need? You need a glass of water, you need a ride to the market, you know? You want to move in and you're dying of some disease and you want to spend 3 years in the bedroom in my house and want me to take care of you? Okay. And it can be really difficult, but okay, there's no longer that difference between self and other. There's not anyone helping someone else, or there's no one being helped. There's no helping. It's effortless. Okay, right? I think this is the teaching. Maybe I'm wrong, but I have the feeling that this is the teaching. And there are ways you can explore this aspect of ultimate bodhicitta through yogacara practices, for example, in the mind-only school. Again, if you wanted to find a meditation practice that opened you up to a fuller appreciation of ultimate bodhicitta and realizing emptiness, the non-self nature of things, the true nature of things, you could go to Reb Anderson's book, The Third Turning of the Wheel. On page 106, it starts four pages of an introduction to the meditation practices, the yogacara practices, that help you experience and see directly this non-conceptual reality that we really live in, at least through the yogacara teachings. It's the teachings of the three natures or three svabhavas, right? The dependent other and the imputational and the thoroughly established. The teaching is to focus on what's dependently arising right now in the world of phenomena. And then you move through these stages of meditation and experience this acquiescence. It's called the acquiescence to the non-production of dharmas. It's the patient acceptance of phenomena as being empty of its own being. There's no essence there, right? So I mention it in case you don't know about it, but you want to explore it. I'm 73, I'm not 75, but I have lived these 73 years under the shadow of the shadowless tree. And I completely identify with him inside the fire pulling off branches. This practice of realizing this non-production of dharmas, the emptiness of phenomena, is endless. It doesn't stop. It goes on and on. And it changes. Sometimes there's a self involved, sometimes there's not a self involved. Sometimes there's a thing and sometimes there's not a thing. I wonder how it is for you right now, right here, in this room, in this place. What is the taste of bodhicitta for you? What's it taste like? What's it feel like? What's arising in your minds? How do you appreciate it? Is that enough? I don't know how many minutes have gone by.
It's enough for a lifetime.
Thank you for sharing with me this recovery of the lived moment. Thank you.
Thank you. Right now, how it feels for me is I feel a little unlocked, like There's bodhicitta to help me, like, kind of unlock the ego of attaining enlightenment, experiencing it. Like, I'm on her coattails. But just really, it feels good to, I'm just so happy I don't have to have my ego wrapped up in it, and it can be present in so many other beautiful ways that are meaningful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, John. When you're speaking of, I think it was Shanti Davis, differentiation of bodhicitta as aspirational and active, or some terms like that. It brought to mind, and I wonder if you agree, the paramitas, the perfections. I see an analogy between the perfection of dana and the perfection, so to speak, of bodhicitta, where it's no longer, as you said, there's no effort. It's manifesting, and you're there too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my understanding of it too. There's the giving and giving. Giving and bodhicitta are synonymous. They're not separate from one another. And that giving at first feels like, well, I'm going to give myself to this sick person for an hour or two, and then I'm going to go home and I'm going to take care of some things, and I'm going to kind of get lost in my personal activities of the day. And then I'm going to get up in the morning and I think I might go spend some time visiting with a friend who needs someone just to talk with them. And it feels like these are segregated, separate moments. But when you get into the giving and it becomes effortless, when you lose this sense of self and other, and it doesn't become material at all to anything, then the giving just comes, it flows. Hongbo says of this non-production of dharmas, it flows in one direction. Why resist it, right? And you reach that point, I think, where you feel, yeah, why resist it? I can give more. I can summon the energy. Even when there seems to be no energy, I can summon more energy. Whatever is needed, I think it's also my name, Danan. Dana is the etymological root of the name my teacher gave me. So I really appreciate this spirit, but only really recently began to feel how limitless it is, how unlimited, and how liberating it can really be.
It seems to me too that the non-separation you mentioned between self and other, where giving takes on a whole different being. This also manifested, perhaps, it seems to me, in the non-separation of the mind also. So there's not a... I guess it's the same thing, really. Non-separation of self and other occurs in the mind. So the mind is undivided. And the problem is still there, but it's...
It's really interesting to go to Reb's take on the meditation on the non-production of dharmas. He points to the teaching that compares the other dependent self, this self that's always arising in relationship to everything else all the time, and it's kind of contextual, right? And it's caught in this web of cause and effect, and we're encouraged to see it as a crystal. And this very clear crystal just absorbs and reflects whatever comes into contact with it. So if you place it on a red cloth, it looks like a ruby, right? if you hold it up to the sky, you know, it'll look like the sky. That's the self that's always here and always active, independent, arising. And then the imputational arises. Oh, mind, we speak of mind, use language to describe the mind. We use language to describe self and other. We use these terms and speak of these concepts. That becomes reflected through this crystal, so to speak, this other dependent self is kind of reaching out and grabbing hold of whatever is there to manifest itself, to reify itself, to make a thing out of itself. And when we see that and can let go of it, the teaching is basically that the thoroughly established things as they really are appears, the suchness, or the just everything just as it is, without being colored by a self, opinions, views, etc.
Thank you so much. I have a question, and I can't quite remember the exact wording of Red Anderson's statement that a thought has its own being.
A thought is a being.
A thought is a being, yes, thank you. So so I'm wondering, I can, at any moment, a thought arises. So in that moment, that thought is alive. It's life. And so if I'm in that moment with the aliveness of what's arising, then at this next moment, it's gone. So that I'm actually not into the future with the thought at all, but it's actually its aliveness is fresh, and it's so, like, amazing to be in that aliveness. But then we don't know what's going to happen next. So
I don't. I agree.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, we're generating some cause and effect train.
Yeah.
So I guess I was concerned about that.
I think there's always change, constant change, and it's all kind of flowing along, you know. There's nothing static, nothing set. There's nothing really set about these teachings either, or about the idea of bodhicitta. You know, forget about bodhicitta. You know, right? When you let go of ideas like thought, or when I let go of bodhicitta, thought and concepts, even of a being, and it is expressed in that I don't know way always when it's freshest, and I don't even know what a thought is or what a being is. I mean, I hear Reb, you know, treat a thought like a being, but and I try, but I also don't know when I let go of it what is that, you know. There's not a there, so to speak.
But there is an experience.
But there is an experience, yeah. There's a lot there.
Exactly. Anybody else? Somebody on Zoom have a question or a thought or a something?
Jim. Oh, look, this showed you. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Thank you for the talk.
Oh, hi.
So you asked, how are we experiencing, how am I experiencing bodhicitta right now? And I would say I'm experiencing it as resistance and non-resistance. So, you know, a thought comes and, well, let's say no thought comes. No thought comes, and I have no resistance to no thought coming. But a thought comes, and then I notice it, and I have some resistance to it. And then I think I just noticed that a thought came and I had some resistance to it. So that's how I experience it. And then I experience not resisting to thoughts.
Did you experience it as helping me when I came earlier and we ate together and you showed me where to change my robe, into my robe? Did you experience it?
Yeah, that was kind of like non-resistance. I didn't have too much resistance to that. It was good to see you, and then you threw us this curveball. You wanted to do this chant in English that we usually do in Japanese, and we'd never done it that way. And for a minute I had some resistance to that. And then I noticed I had some resistance to that. And then I'm noticing I had some resistance to that. I didn't want to really have resistance to that, so I kind of let it go. And I thought, oh, how would it be to do that chant in English? Yeah. Wow, that would be different.
Yeah.
And I was really, one thing I noticed is that our head Doan also, you know, displayed a remarkable non-resistance. So I really appreciated that, Clem. That was, I felt like we were working on it together. So thank you. I just had to say that.
It's really wonderful the way that thoughts become central to the practice sometimes. I mean, we chant, you know, we practice non-thinking. How do you practice not thinking, non-thinking? And I think we come away from those kinds of teachings thinking that thinking is a problem or thoughts are a problem. Thoughts are a wonderful way of practicing. Like you were just practicing with thoughts. Like we began talking about a thought, right?
Yeah, thank you for your talk, John. I was quite taken with the acquiescence to the non-production of dharmas, and I think what Jim pointed out was actually that in practice. Because I wanted to ask you about it, but ever since the question started, you've talked about nothing but that, so I have no question. Thank you very much.
Thank you for not having a question. What? I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. Could I ask you to repeat that?
I said you could thank me, too. I don't have a question.
You could thank me. I had a question. I just asked.
I don't know where this comes from, but it does remind me of the phrase, with our thoughts we create the world. Well, I think that's true. So I think that's all I have to say.
Well, thank you for creating the world.
Thank you.
Can we say that bodhicitta is the web of interconnection that we speak of a lot?
Is bodhicitta the web of interconnections?
The interconnection comes up a lot, the study of interconnection.
It's the study of the interconnections, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, the thought of awakening could be take the form of the study of interdependence, or the study of dependent co-arising, or the study of emptiness, or the study of compassion in action. Yeah, it's really animating everything I think I experience as practice. Now, do you all agree? Yeah. Resistance.
It's like maybe only looking back for me, I might say, oh, this.
What do you call bodhicitta? This movement towards enlightenment was already moving me. And then only later do I see that that's maybe what was happening, because I can often be in a situation like, well, how did I get here?
Yeah.
Or, gosh, I didn't know I would, that this would be in my life now, or something like that.
Yeah. And the Mumenkan, the Gateless Gate in Case 23, Good and Evil, Don't Think Good and Evil, there's a story about the Huineng, the sixth ancestor, and I find the Platform Sutra especially redolent of this bodhicitta activity. Before the story in Koan 23, in which Huineng is told to leave and escape because there are a lot of jealous people at the monastery who won't like the fact he's just been granted the, bestowed with the gift of the bowl and robe of the Buddha. And he's pursued by this general Ming, and Ming, kind of an aggressive, tough character, corners Huineng on this mountain ridge. And Huineng says, wait, let's not fight over the bowl and robe. It's here. It's right here. Take it if let's not fight. And Ming can't pick it up, right? It's sort of like Robert Aiken, in his commentary on this koan, compares it to eating a fish. He's a vegetarian, but he goes through this period when he can't get anything but, you know, protein, but everyone's eating animals, fish. And he went along with it a little bit, but then he finds himself with this fish on a plate in front of him and a fork in his hand, and he can't bring the fork to the fish, right? He just can't do it. Just like Ming can't pick up this robe and bowl. Early on in the Platform Sutra story of Huineng, Huineng is a young person. He's a woodcutter. His father is dead. He's supporting his mother, and he's already, I think, a person of bodhicitta, and he's passing through the town square, and he hears a line from the Diamond Sutra: "Dwelling no place, raise the mind of Buddha," and it stops him cold. He has a sudden awakening. Dwelling nowhere, raise the mind of true nature. And he thinks, he goes to the monk who he heard recite this line, and he says, where did you learn this? And the monk says, from the fifth ancestor, right? And immediately, Huineng thinks, I'm going to go there. So what does he do next? This person who's already alive with bodhicitta. The story says, it's easy to miss. The story makes clear, he thought, I must see after my mother. I can't go and leave her without any support. I have to take care of my mother. Before going off to find this great wise teacher and ask him to share more of this wisdom, it's bodhicitta, isn't it? It's turning to help others. And then later, there's a conversation between him and Jungin in the monastery where he ends up going to the threshing hall. But later, up on this mountaintop where Ming is approaching him, he meets him with such, calls it grandmotherly care. He gives himself to Ming. This general's come to take away what he's just been given, and he meets him with this great compassion and wisdom. He gives himself everything he's got to Ming. You can read about it in the koan. There's this wonderful exchange about one's real face, your face before your parents were born, right? And that teaching, it's so touching. Hui Neng is like this, suddenly become for me this model of bodhicitta in action. And he has that ultimate bodhicitta way, energy about him when he's encountering Ming. He's giving. There's no end to it. It's an unremitting stream flowing in one direction from this teacher, right? And that's what the fifth ancestor saw and realized, I think, and why he gave him the bowl and the robe anyway. I think we're done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.